Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi there. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies. I'm one of your hosts, Lori Dickmeyer. I just finished speaking with Dr. Peng Yang Hui about his new book, Strait Rituals, China, Taiwan, and the United States in the Taiwan Strait Crises, 1954 to 1958. We spoke about his fortuitous access to PRC and ROC records, in addition to walking through some of the public events and tacit communication that happened among these three big powers in the 1950s. Ultimately, Peng Yang Hui explores the Taiwan Strait crises as a transition from tacit communication to tacit accommodation. We conclude the interview with a reflection on the broader significance of this project for today's world of politics and his upcoming projects. I hope you enjoy the interview. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies. I'm your host, Lori Dickmeyer. Today, we're talking to Dr. Peng Yang Hui about his book, Strait Rituals, China, Taiwan, and the U.S. in the Taiwan Strait Crises, 1954 to 58. Yang Hui, welcome to the show.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for having me here. Yeah.
Could you start us off by telling a little bit about your background?
Yeah. Currently, I'm a lecturer at the Singapore University of Technology and Design, where I teach some liberal arts kind of subjects. And I also give my own electives, such as Modern China, World History, and various other subjects. Yeah.
And could you tell us how you became interested in this topic, the Taiwan Strait Crises? How did you come to write a book about it?
Right. So the interest in it started when I was doing my master's research. I was doing on President Nixon's foreign policy with regards to North Vietnam. In particular, his military operation, Operation Linebacker. So I did that and I finished it. And I was thinking about doing my PhD and then after that. But I sort of got sidetracked by the fact that when I was reading the documents that I found out, and also his memoirs, that he was actually the vice president of President Eisenhower. So that got me very intrigued, right? I started reading about his vice presidency. And one thing got to another, and then I started reading more about his role in the Eisenhower administration. And so the interesting thing is, before Eisenhower, the first year of Eisenhower's administration, he actually sent Nixon, his VP, all around the world, right? So this is, so we are talking about the 1950s, right? And so because Nixon had a kind of odious reputation in terms of Ray Bader and so on and so forth, so you would expect that Nixon, well, stereotypically, you know, being, I mean, he sounds like a redneck. So the thing is, from the transcripts of when he had with the world statesmen all around the world, that did not turn out to be so. In particularly, what's even more interesting is when he returned from his world tour to the National Security Council back in Eisenhower's administration when he was giving the debrief to both the CIA debriefers and also his colleagues in Eisenhower's cabinet, you are really blown away. And you begin to understand that why is it possible for Nixon in 1972 to have a rapprochement with China? It's because this guy is not as simplistic as what you think, that he's just a rate baiter and you know, so on and so forth. That this guy really have the world vision, and it was formed as early as the Eisenhower administration when he was just a VP. Now, in American politics, as you know better than me, the VP, of course, has very little political role, right? But Nixon managed to turn it around, and it served sort of like a, excuse me for the bad analogy, but it's like a PhD for him, you know, in international politics. So that's how I managed to move on into my current research on the Taiwan Straits crisis. So as I dig further into it, I become more and more interested in it, and that's how I started on this topic.
Yeah, and one thing you mentioned in the introduction to your book, that looking at this topic, that your book is one of the few maybe that looks at sources in kind of a deep way from Taiwan, the U.S., and from the PRC. So I'm wondering if you could introduce us a little bit to your source base.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So what's interesting is in 2004, the PRC Foreign Ministry Archives was sort of opened up in a tentative sort of way to absolutely outsiders, you know. So in 2008, I managed to get a travel grant to go there to take a look and stay there for 3 months. So this is absolutely the kind of unprecedented, because we know that the PRC archives was never open to outsiders, and that those official kind of Mao Zedong biography that was published officially by the government of PRC itself were highly kind of controlled affairs, whereby the documents, although it was cited in the official biography, those sources are nonetheless not available to outsiders. So this, when the PRC Foreign Ministry Archives was opened in 2004, and I went there in 2008, certainly there were a lot of interest in it, and absolutely when I went there, one is sort of electrified, right, by the fact that you are looking at documents for the first time that has not been available for the general reading public for a very long time. So that's one thing. When I went there, only around 60% of the documents are reviewed, as the archivist told me. And they, at that time, they had plans to further review this all the way until perhaps the Vietnam War. So I was very lucky then, I guess, in choosing a topic that's in the 1950s, because had I followed my initial research, which was Nixon and the Vietnam War, you know, documents would not be available at the time. So I had a whale of a time looking at documents from PRC. There are some restrictions. I mean, number one, of course, there are only 60% of the documents available. So, and also if there are high-level documents, if involves the signature of Mao himself or Zhuan Lai, you had to hand copy, right? So all this, of course, things kind of restrict the speed that you can take down documents. Other than that, the other thing that was also interesting was in Taipei, whereby the archive Guo Shi Guan. So when I was there, documents that, I think, if I remember correctly, documents with regards to Chiang Kai-shek himself and Chiang Jing-kuo, his son, these documents, although they are sort of PDF, and you can see it on a screen, but nonetheless, you cannot print those documents. You have to electronically kind of copy the documents. So that really slowed down, you know, I mean, I guess you know, because you yourself are a historian, right? So, but what is interesting is 2008 was during the presidency of Chen Shui-bian. And Chen Shui-bian himself, the fact that he was not from KMT, Kuomintang, he had every interest in opening up the archives, because in the hope, I guess, digging up dirt on Kashi himself. But what's interesting is that whatever that had already been said about Chiang Kai-shek had been said, and the opening of archives added to the nuances, but not to, like, not any earth-shattering discoveries. But nonetheless, it is very, very mind-blowing, because to see, as I said in my book, Fan Gong Da Lu, right, the retaking of mainland China. So you have all these plans, and how the sort of the general staff of the ROC army wrote it up. And then you have Chiang Kai-shek's commands at the side of the documents. And it's interesting because in 19th century, at least for Qing Dynasty, if you send up a memorial to the emperor, right, the emperor will sort of write his comments at the site using vermilion ink, right, which is red in color. Here, Chiang Kai-shek did the same thing. You know, he write comments like approve, not approve, or deserve more consideration, and so on and so forth. So, it's kind of interesting. The PRC documents, you don't see any of these notations. I believe all these important notations, documents that with these notations, were not reviewed. All right. But for the ROC side, you can see, literally, you can see, Chiang Kai-shek is reading the documents, you can see sort of the internal debate he's having with the documents' authors itself. So that's that. For both the Chinese sources, which forms around 70% of my research. The last 30% is, of course, Eisenhower's Presidential Library in Abilene. Very pleasant place. In each of these places, Taipei, Beijing, and Abilene, I spent 3 months each, so a total of 9 months. in Abilene itself, documents, the standard of archival retrieval, is world class, right? Nothing could be said, you know. In terms of documentation, sort of the National Security Council minutes were very, very important to me. Before I went, of course, you have all those commercially available sort of microfilm of the National Security Council kind of reels that are published, you know, by companies such as Nexus, right? But the problem with going through those reels is that you can't really depend on them, because those were done in the 1980s. And if you go through the reels, there will be a lot of blanks whereby they will say that classified, you know. So when I went there in 2008, the real documents, when you look at the real documents, those are available. Those that previously classified documents are now declassified. And I asked for some FOIA documents myself. This book is, I'm able to write this book really because of this fortuitous kind of confluence of events, whereby the three sources are available at that point in time. So So you might find it very strange. Why did I say that? Why is this fortuitous? Because as recent as 2001-05, the Wilson Center, which is, of course, the center that has all these COVID documents, right? They contacted me, and I came to know about the gradual closing again of the PRC Foreign Ministry archives. If you just do a simple Google word search, you find that a lot of graduate students, in fact, have to change their topic midway because they simply cannot get access to the documents the way I had in 2008. So that's why I say this fortunate for me. Yeah,
that's really great that worked out. Then, why don't we just jump straight into your second chapter? So this is where you open up with talking about how this kind of hostile relationship involving the PRC in Taiwan and the U.S. emerges, kind of during this period 1950 to 54. So. And you talk about this leading up to the Geneva Conference in 1954. So I wonder if you could just briefly walk through the concerns of those three main powers during those years.
Yeah. So the book itself, what I have is I have two chapters each covering a kind of a major concern. So chapter two and chapter three. Actually covers the concern of Geneva, which is after the Korean War, and chapter 4 and 5 covers the first Taiwan Strait crisis. And then there's a break. Chapter 6 and chapter 7 and 8 covers the second Taiwan Strait crisis. So in chapter 2 itself, what's important is. What I try to draw for the readers is the origins and the making of the contents over the control of the Taiwan Strait. And I sort of noted that it's important to deal with the major developments in the foreign relations of US, PRC, and ROC from this period of time. So this sort of set up the scene for the Geneva conference in the tree in itself. So chapter two is sort of like, you know, is if I may be allowed to make a sort of analogies like the Shakespearean play, right? You set up the pieces and then you set up a scene, what's the context? So that's really in chapter two. And of course, the biggest thing that the background of it all is, of course, the war in Vietnam by the French. Yeah, doing very badly in, all right? So, and then I go on to three, whereby I talk about several things that in this book, I talk about some cultural values. I talk about roles of ritualization. And these are not the common things that diplomatic historians talk about, but I managed to talk about it more. Really, again, it's a link to the fact that this is only available because of the mid-level functionary documents that are available from the PRC itself, whereby they have all this kind of discussion about how do they present themselves in Geneva, right? So, and then you have all this access to their thinking, and then it become possible to write about it. So in general, what we have then in chapter three, right, after the setting up of all the scenes in chapter two, is that you find that China was able to have this, what I call a cultural blitzkrieg, you know, in combination with real politics, this interlocking of cultural display and real politics in the conference itself. So you have China itself. They hired this almost like chateau, which is close to well, I guess contemporary understanding is like almost a small palace, you know, and they imported in a lot of cultural artifacts to populate the place, and they entertain people at the this place whereby the Chinese were showcased to the world. So it might strike you as curious, and like, why would the Chinese bother to do that? Well, that's because China, in the aftermath of the Korean War, was effectively a pariah, right? And that, so you have this monolithic, stereotypical view of China being communist. You know, they almost they do not understand, you know, the finer qualities of culture and so on and so forth. So the Geneva Conference then became an avenue for the Chinese to showcase to the world. And you have on the record from the United States documents and also from the Chinese side, whereby the Americans were disgruntled about how the Chinese were able to turn this into a propaganda kind of fiesta, you know? And then the Chinese did it effectively, right? Zhou Enlai was on the record for telling his subordinates that the entire conference must be coordinated. If you've read a chapter, it talks about Mei Lanfang, which is, of course, Peking Opera. So this theatrical kind of connection with real politics, I find it fascinating, because in the collusion of the, for example, the emissaries from Cambodia and Laos and even Burma with the Chinese, you find that although they display kind of this sort of cultural, you know, they, for example, they screen the movie The Butterfly Lovers. And but at the same time, on the other hand, the Chinese themselves engage in intensive negotiation by the side. And so, and when you read through transcripts, what's amazing is that you find that countries like Laos and Cambodia, they would the emissaries, all right? I mean, from the name, you cannot tell that these guys were actually ethnically Chinese. But from the transcript, they actually say something like, oh, you know, that PRC is like an elder brother, you know? And then, of course, then the Chinese would do the perfunctionary thing, like, you know, waving it off, saying, oh, no, no, it's not a concern, you know, please don't concern yourself about that, you know. We are here to negotiate real things. For example, how do I end the Vietnam War, at least the first part. So in many parts here, we also know in the Geneva, so cultural parts, I mean, in Antonio Gramsci talked about cultural hegemony, right? So here is displayed overtly, and you find that the Chinese were able to pressure the Vietnamese to literally accept the partition of Vietnam. So this in itself is the real politic part. So you have the cultural part, and then we have the real politic part. And another aspect that's interesting in the Geneva chapter is the fact that Beadle Smith, which was the director of CIA, all right, he himself was there as Under Secretary of State. And so previously he was director of CIA, and then his capacity during the Geneva was Under Secretary of State. So Beadle Smith performs this service of sort of what I call in my book tacit communication. Sort of engaged the ambassador, all right, in a sort of communication, right? So, and then clearly they're not supposed to shake hands. So Peter Smith then grabbed hold of the ambassador's shirt sleeve and sort of, like, all right, I'm not shaking your hand, but I'm shaking your shirt sleeve. So establishing communication. They talk about, I mean, of course, a lot of real content were like, nothing significant was concluded. But that was the first step of the what I call tacit communication. And this in the part itself, what is interesting is the Chinese ambassador himself, would actually mention this in his own memoir about how this is important in the subsequent negotiation leading up to 1958 and also in Kennedy's time. So then this itself then is chapter three.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah.
And I think it's great that you're mentioning this point of tacit communication, because that's something that it goes throughout your book, right? That this is something that continues during the first Taiwan Strait crisis, the second, and forward from there. So let's go to chapter four, right? And in this chapter, this is four and five. Yeah, they go together, right? Since they're both about the first Taiwan Strait crisis. And this is your reevaluation of what happens now that we have China launching this huge or a massive artillery bombardment of two islands. So why don't you take it from there? Tell us what leads to this and how do China, Taiwan, and the U.S. react following all this?
So part of the what I'm trying to argue that was first started in the Geneva, this tacit communication, was later on continued in the First Taiwan Strait crisis, whereby in Geneva and subsequently after Geneva, Beijing had conveyed its political concerns about the Taiwan problem and its peaceful intentions in a multiplicity of ways to a wide variety of international contexts. Washington tried to do the same thing at the same time, all right, to counter this kind of Chinese push. So they try to use also the UN Security Council. They try to pick up, you know, like, for example, Operation Oracle that's supposedly proposed by the New Zealanders. We know it's not. It is actually a brainchild of the United States itself, but using another country to talk about it, right? To engage what Beijing as a form of communication with Beijing, because at that point in time, as I said, Beijing was an international pariah, right? So they do not have ambassadors at each other's places, and this is the only way they can communicate with each other. So the thing, what's important to talk about is that despite the barrage, but despite the superficial so-called on 13 March 55, no, 16 March 55, Eisenhower was off, raise the ante by having a nuclear threat. What we do have here is, if you look at the documents, is that both sides had this very great flexibility, and they actually inched towards Bandung, right, conference, with intention to tacitly resolve the crisis. And throughout all this, we have the person of the UN Secretary General, Hamas Jo, Whereby he tried to do like the honest broker and connected to both. And what's interesting is that so this tacit communication did not in no way in my book I'm trying to say that it comes about naturally or, you know, it's preordained or something like that. But it's actually a result of very hard work, right, on all parties. For example, in the United States themselves, they do not appreciate the efforts of Hamas Jo, right? They find him sort of, for lack of a better word, like a nosy Parker, right? Poking his nose into U.S. affairs, although he is the U.N. Secretary General. One funny episode regards to the Chinese was that Hamas Jo managed to corner one of the ambassadors. And sort of engaged in a kind of monologue with the Chinese ambassador, more than 2 hours. And it was one of those very rare moments whereby it's actually funny because the Chinese side, although they really appreciate the efforts of Hamas Jo, but the ambassador himself was kind of overwhelmed by the verbal assault of Hamas Jo, because he can go on and on a monologue. So, and this was recorded in the minute. And and what's even more ironic is that Hamas Jo calls this quiet diplomacy. So it's nothing. It's very far from being quiet. But nonetheless, both sides. The PRC made a conciliatory gesture on 23rd April 1955. To sort of resolve the crisis and paving the way for the Sino-US ambassador to be held in Geneva in August 1955. What I find interesting in all this is that you'll find this attempt, both sides using signaling and various symbolic things to sort of signal the end of the crisis, and at the same time you have the role of ROC Taipei, Taiwan, whereby they were furiously pushing for additional US engagement, right? So even though the two sides did not come to blows with each other, the only China basically bombarded Quemoy and Matsu in September 1954, and subsequently in 1955, Jan, they took one of the islands, which is Yichang-san and Ta-Shan Island. All this was not kind of like, there was, again, quoting from Macbeth, is full of sound and fury, but what is really lost is not really apparent, right? Because the ROC itself, not only did they gain the Mutual Defense Treaty on 2nd December 1954, they also gained the Formosa Resolution 9 Jan, whereby American promised to defend the offshore island. So you find in this episode itself, ROC, Chiang Kai-shek in particular, the powers of Chiang Kai-shek in high-level diplomacy and maneuvering, as was stated in earlier books such as by Barbara Touchman, like a book about Stilwell, right? All this is displayed here, right? And he's very good seizing opportunity to advance Taiwan's position, right? He managed to get more aid, treaties, even the Formosa Resolution. What you have is that. So previous writers, when they talk about Taiwan Strait crisis, they always talk about misperception, But what we, if you look at closer at the documents, what you find then is both sides pretty much have an appreciation. They're willing to take their time. That's why the crisis lasts from 54 to 55. To actually actively feeling out each other and resolving it. So, yeah, that's the time, first time.
Yeah, great. And your next part of your book discusses this pretty short period of time, a couple of years, when there we don't have a crisis, right? It's the gap in between the first and second Taiwan Strait crisis. And you kind of highlight four main issues that you think contribute to or are relevant for Sino-U.S. Taiwan relations. So I was wondering if you could maybe pick one or two of those. So you talk about, obviously you've mentioned these a little bit already, but Sino-U.S. ambassadorial talks, that particular issue, ROC, PRC secret back channels during this period, the May 1957 Taiwan riots, and then the ROC and its Fen Gong mission. So if you want to pick one or two of those and talk about them. I'd love to hear about those.
Yeah. So so in the book, right, I talk about how so this tacit communication then become accommodation in the ambassadorial talks. So what we then have is this engagement, constant engagement in communication. And we know that If both parties belligerents continue communicating with each other, there's less likelihood for coming to blows with each other, right? At least there is an avenue for talk. And the both sides engage in it, and I find it because if you're familiar with, for example, the Marshall, General Marshall, for example, in during the Chinese Civil War in the earlier period, was in China to negotiate between the ROC and the PRC. The KMT and the Kuomintang. So during those times, the communists always like to talk about tan tan da da. That means fighting while negotiating, and this was of course displayed during Geneva. It's the same advice they advised the non-Vietnamese. And during this time, the ambassadorial talks was something like that. Right? It's like, while we can engage in talks, we talk about it. If we can't, then we exchange a few blows. So so this in itself, of course, the Chinese hoped to gain something, but they did not, because the Americans, although they are willing to engage in, they keep the communication channels open, but they're not willing to go that far because they have their domestic constituents to care about, right? Because China lobby at the time was still very strong. So, of course, then there were inconclusive results at the end of 1957. So, thus, in this particular ambassadorial talks, we can see that tacit communication or so leading to tacit accommodation, while it is useful in keeping the communication channel open, it has its severe limitations. That means what it means is that it really can't resolve anything, right? So in itself, then it is interesting because the Taiwanese themselves, right, they were fuming, right, at the site. And they themselves also launched their so-called, what they call, secret channels, right? So this in itself is interesting because the so-called the CIA itself actually did a study during Nixon's time of possible ROC and PRC back-channel communication. And the evidence that was from the CIA report was not conclusive, as in they didn't think that Chang Jing-guo, right, so which is the son of translation would kind of engage in it in a very fundamental way, right? It's true, because back channel is a kind of a reaction to this ambassadorial talks. So the thing is, ROC is saying, all right, you, if Washington is engaging Beijing in Geneva talks, we can engage in our back channel talks with Beijing unilaterally. And that's it itself, I find it interesting, because if you look at it in the kind of a real politic kind of way, it's difficult to explain, right? But if you look at a cultural kind of way, it is easier to understand. I mean, in fact, both sides constantly uses things like, oh, you know, we are brothers, but, you know, but because of political differences, and now we are fighting. Then again, back channel talks, right, did not really resolve anything, but it just sort of kept the communication channels open. Again, as I said, you know, tacit communication or tacit accommodation has its limitations. In chapter, this particular chapter, sustaining linkages, I talk about it. And in subsequently chapter 8, I also talk about it. Both chapters, when I talk about back channels, what Taipei had, it is always, Taipei is always very wary of how it may pan out. So nothing was very much promised. Because at the same time, one may ask, why did the United States not detect this earlier? Why was the CIA so-called study was only conducted during President Nixon's time, right? Because this thing happened in the 50s, right? Well, the point is, you have a country that is sort of in a supplicant position to the United States. So this country, Taiwan, in my book, I use the concept that was developed elsewhere by another historian. That is what you call the leverage of the weak. So he's able to portray himself as this, like this sort of and political innocent, right? And the United States went along that, you know, he's such a jolly good fellow or loyal, you know, anti-communist. So Pan Jingguo would never engage in back channels. So this in itself is like kind of binder, right? Blinder, that the United States did not really catch on only until the 1970s. I mean, there are two other issues, but I think in the interest of time, I'll move on.
So yeah, if we want to move on to now to the second Taiwan crisis that happens in 1958, the end of August. It lasts a much shorter amount of time. So I was wondering if you could talk to us about why is this second crisis resolved so quickly?
So what we can see then, what the clinches the entire argument of this tacit communication, the tacit accommodation, really comes to fruition when you look at the National Security Council the kind of minutes with Dallas, Eisenhower, and with their chief of staff. So you find that both sides by this time, right, with the lessons in the ambassadorial period, with lessons of Geneva, with lessons of First Taiwan Straits Crisis, they know each other sort of like they kind of what they are capable of and what they really want. So the same goes for the Chinese side, right? In fact, Mao in his First Taiwan Straits Crisis displayed remarkable restraint, right? He gives instruction like to his frontline commanders, like when you send barrages over the Taiwan Strait, can you make sure that none of the high explosive bombs fall onto the American ships. So the frontline commanders were, of course, they were not amused by this kind of instruction because, you know, at least it's like interference, right, of the military commanders. But then Mao, you have documents that says that he, whereby he says that, you know, this is a political war. It's not really a military war. So then it lays out very clearly that bombardment is a symbolic kind of sign to display displeasure in the First Taiwanese Crisis over CETO, Southeast Asian Treaty Organization, with the fact that Geneva sort of what was gained for Vietnam, supposedly they agreed at the end of Geneva to have kind of elections were not held. So to display the displeasure. So in the Taiwan Straits, second Taiwan Straits crisis, similarly, Mao wanted to send the signal, right? So this is the thing, is to send a signal, not really to conquer the offshore islands. So both, he was sending signals to two parties. Number one is to Khrushchev, who Mao thinks is interfering in Chinese politics. And the other party that he wants to send signal to is the Americans, right? Because the Americans, by that time, equipped Taipei with Matador missiles, which is nuclear tip, right? So this in itself, and he has to send a signal that this is not going to sit well with the PRC, right? But nonetheless, once the sort of barrage was launched at the offshore islands, even the ROC themselves, for example, they have reports from the front line, Jingmen, sending back to Chiang Kai-shek that this barrage in itself, all right, as you can, both from the documents that were sent from the front line to Chiang Kai-shek and also from evidence of Chiang Kai-shek's diary itself, both indicated very clearly that the ROC knew that this was a symbolic barrage. It was not a precursor to a general invasion of the offshore islands. So all sides, even CIA reports, you know, they are very, very clear that it's a symbolic, right? And so, because by this time they are so clear about each other's intention, I argue then communication, this has reached its peak, whereby the accommodation is achieved with remarkable restraint and very quickly, as you have just mentioned yourself. Dallas himself detailed experiences painfully gained in 1955 as fundamental to the tacit accommodation reached in the aftermath of the crisis. So therefore, I argue, armed with good intelligence, new experiences with Beijing's modus operandi, Eisenhower at once concluded the Taiwan Strait crisis will blow over, right? So, although in the National Security Council minutes, you find that you have all his chiefs talking about nuclear bombing of various cities, Eisenhower quickly shut them down, right? Saying, no, you're not going to have that. Okay, so this itself is very interesting in the sense that kind of sensing of the enemy, right? This And that's why it was quickly wrapped up. And then you have the Warsaw negotiation going on very quickly to wrap things up. Yeah.
Yeah. And in chapter 8, you talk about now that, you know, basically this situation is being wrapped up, peace is in sight, that these three powers are reacting to that peace in some interesting ways. We have the U.S. and the PRC claiming credit for it. We have Taiwan kind of going on to use it for nation-building purposes. Could you talk a little bit about how they all go forward with the Taiwan Strait as kind of a useful element for themselves?
Yeah. So there's this element of theatrical, right? So again, I use a perhaps not a very accurate analogy of again, the Shakespeare play, right? So you find that so in terms of actual accomplishment, well, I guess if we look at a big picture that no nuclear strikes were initiated, then it's a huge achievement, right? But if we look at, are there any substantive things they've achieved? Like, for example, did we solve the two China question? Of course not, right? That's why until today we have phase off, right, over the Taiwan Straits. So it really depends on what you're looking at. So interestingly, when I first sent the book manuscript to the publisher, and I had my two reviewers, one of the reviewers mentioned that I should sort of go back and talk about the what you call, because in the 50s, Chiang Kai-shek's attempt to take back China is rhetorically Fan Gong Da Lu. In the 60s, it becomes Guo Guang Ji Hua, whereby I mentioned that on page 257, right? So I have a little section devoted to it, sort of like the aftermath. You find that, again, Chiang Kai-shek sort of ratchet up the rhetoric, but the United States did not bite. And this time around, it is Jack Kennedy's time. And he uses the tacit accommodation or the back channel that were really established with China to deliver the message that we are not going to be engaged in a war over offshore islands, period. All right? Never mind what ROC said. So this itself was very interesting because the speed that was achieved was even shorter than the second Taiwan Straits crisis. So this is in Jack Kennedy's time. It was so some authors talk about the third Taiwan Straits crisis. I did not. So I sort of mentioned it towards the end. So this in itself, again, give credence to this attempts to build accommodation between belligerents. So I was glad that the reviewer suggested it, and I did more research, and I was able to write up a few pages on it on this during the 60s. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds good. Well, I think we might be wrapping up here in a second, but is there anything else you wanted to say about your book as a whole or any kind of takeaway points?
Yeah. Sort of because at this point, especially the theatrical part, I find it interesting and is totally relevant to nowadays. For example, we talk about the Trump administration, right? Mm-hmm. I'm sure you every day you will be bombarded with things, what is said about Trump, his foreign policy, and so forth. What's one interesting thing is towards the end of the Second Taiwan Straits Crisis, if you have read a chapter, all sides declare victory, right? Like, oh, you know, we have done this. We have told the Chinese to back down. The Chinese have also said, you know, we told the Americans to back off. And the Taiwanese, of course, said, oh, yeah, you know, it's all great. You know, Taiwan is still here and we get more aid, you know. But what's important is that you find that today, if you look at Trump administration, we have his perennial declaration of victory, right? That he has achieved victory in this, he has achieved victory in that. So you find that this is interesting because then you find that PRC by now sort of sensing, right? Again, we talk about ritualization, right? They have sensed that Trump's always need a victory, right?
Mm-hmm.
For him to declare it's a victory. Whether substantively anything was achieved, it really doesn't matter. Because, you know, midterm elections are coming up, you know, or presidential elections are coming up. What's more important is for the spin, right? So that's the interesting thing that I find about this study having relevance to even today, how we look at international politics. Yeah,
very interesting. Well, Yang Wei, we've taken a lot of your time up, but I'm sure our listeners readers are interested in what you're working on now. Could you tell us what that is?
Yeah. So right now, I'm working on sort of the first thing that I'm working on is on is a spin-off from this study, which is on the nuclear energy development and weapons development. Obviously, it came from the fact that Eisenhower sort of threatened on 16 March 55. So I want to look at China's reaction to it, especially how the scientific establishment in China, in the person of the scientists, especially with regards to Qian Shanqiang, which is the father of Chinese nuclear development, sort of like biographical approach. In the 50s, he came back to China. In the 60s, yeah, he endured the Cultural Revolution. And finally, in the 80s, when Ping Fan, right, he was able to become the university president of Zhejiang University. So this in itself is tracing. But at the same time, I was also looking at Taiwanese side, how they also wanted to sort of develop their nuclear capabilities. And how, of course, Americans shut it down in 1987. So that's the potentially the second book project. Yeah.
Sounds great. Well, thanks again, Yanghui, for being on the show. And I really enjoyed it. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Lori Dickmeyer. Thank you for listening.